Okay, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be here.
We've got the material you sent over, quite a bit of it, actually. All about government stepping into markets. Why they do it, how they do it.
That's right. It's a fundamental topic.
So that's our mission for this deep dive, really. To use these sources and just unpack the main ways governments intervene when, you know, markets aren't quite perfect.
Explore the why, the how, the outcomes.
Exactly. All based on the info we have right here.
And the core idea kicking things off in the material is market failure. That's the main driver.
Right. Markets are great, but not always flawless.
Precisely. The sources mention the usual suspects' externalities. Think pollution, where costs spill over.
Mm-hmm.
Public goods, like, say, national defense, which are hard for markets to provide.
Because you can't really charge for them easily.
Exactly. The free rider problem.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's imperfect information, monopolies, these kinds of issues.
So the interventions aren't just random shots in the dark?
No, no. As the material lays out, they're meant to be specific tools for specific problems. It's about understanding that toolkit.
Okay, let's dive into that toolkit then. First up, something we probably all encounter pretty often, indirect taxes.
Yes. Taxes on spending.
The material you shared mentions their taxes on expenditure, basically on buying and selling stuff.
Right.
And it breaks them down into two main types.
Correct. You've got specific taxes, sometimes called unit taxes. That's a fixed amount per item.
Like 50 cents per gallon of fuel, maybe? Regardless of the price.
Exactly that. Or per pack of cigarettes. Then the other type is ad valorem.
Ad valorem sounds fancy.
It just means according to value. So it's a percentage of the price. VAT is the classic example. Sales tax too.
Got it. And the sources say the immediate effect is what? It makes things more expensive for firms to supply?
Essentially, yes. It increases their costs. So graphically, the supply curve shifts left or upwards.
Which means, usually, a higher price for us consumers.
And a lower quantity sold overall compared to if there were no tax.
Okay, but here's the bit the sources seem to really focus on. Who actually pays the tax? The incidents.
Ah, the burden sharing. Yes, that's crucial. It's not just about who physically hands the money over.
It depends on elasticity. Is that right?
Spot on. Price elasticity of demand and supply. Remember, elasticity is just how much quantity changes when price changes.
So if demand is inelastic, people keep buying even if the price goes up. Like, maybe gasoline in the short term.
Precisely. Or things seen as necessities or addictive goods. If demand is inelastic, the sources show consumers end up bearing most of the tax burden. They pay the higher price because they don't cut back much.
But if demand is elastic, people are sensitive to the price, lots of substitutes available.
Then producers have to absorb more of the tax. They can't just pass it all on without losing a ton of sales, so maybe they accept a lower profit margin.
Interesting. It really depends on the specific market.
Absolutely. The shapes of those curves tell the story.
And why do governments use these taxes? The material mentions a few reasons. Raising money is the obvious one.
Raising revenue, yes, that's key. But it's not the only goal.
They also use them to discourage demerit goods, right? Like smokes and booze.
Exactly. Make them pricier, hope people consume less. It's behavior change.
And the sources also talked about internalizing externalities. That sounds important.
It is. Think about pollution again. A factory pollutes, creating costs for society, health problems, environmental damage that aren't in the product's price.
Right, it's an external cost.
So a tax on the pollution or the polluting product tries to build that external cost into the price, makes the polluter and ultimately the consumer pay something closer to the true social cost.
Using the price signal to fix a market flaw.
That's the idea, correcting the market failure.
Okay, so taxes make things more expensive. Let's flip that. The sources also cover subsidies.
The other side of the coin, yes.
Which are basically payments to producers.
Financial grants, yeah. Designed to lower their production costs.
So the market impact is the opposite of a tax. Lower costs mean supply shifts, right?
Downwards or to the right, correct. Which typically means a lower price for consumers.
And more of the good being produced and sold.
Generally, yes.
And the reasons for subsidies, according to the material, also quite varied.
Very much so. A big one is promoting merit goods.
Things deemed good for us, like education or vaccines.
Exactly. Stuff the market might underprovide because individuals don't fully appreciate the benefits or can't afford them. Subsidies make them cheaper, encouraging uptake.
The sources also mention supporting producers. Agriculture comes up a lot.
Yeah, helping farmers manage volatile prices, ensuring a stable income. That's a common use.
And also encouraging exports. or new industries.
Yes, helping domestic firms compete internationally or giving a leg up to infant industries. Sometimes it's also about correcting other market failures or even reducing inequality by lowering the cost of essentials.
And just like with taxes, the sources look at who really benefits from the subsidy. It's not automatically the producer who gets the check.
Not necessarily. Again, it comes down to those elasticities.
Same logic.
Pretty much symmetrical. If demand is relatively inelastic, consumers aren't very responsive to the price change. They tend to capture more of the benefit.
How so?
Because the lower cost gets passed on as a significantly lower price, and consumers buy it without dramatically increasing quantity. Most of the subsidy shows up as a price reduction.
But if supply is inelastic, maybe it's hard for producers to quickly increase output.
Then the producers tend to capture more of the subsidy benefit. They get the payment, but the price doesn't fall as much because supply can't easily expand.
It's quite neat how that mirrors the tax incidence.
It is. Same underlying economic principles at work.
But the sources are careful to point out subsidies aren't a free lunch. There are downsides.
Definitely. Potential for inefficiency is one. Firms might get complacent, less focused on cost control if they're propped up by subsidies.
Right. Less pressure. And maybe overproduction? Creating surpluses?
That's another risk, especially in agriculture sometimes. And the big one, they cost money.
Yeah. Taxpayers ultimately foot the bill. It's a fiscal cost.
A significant one, often.
Okay. Moving on from tweaking prices. The material also talks about the government just providing things directly.
Direct provision, yes. Stepping in as the supplier.
And the main reason seems to be when the market just completely fails to provide something, like public goods.
That's a primary driver. Public goods, remember, have those two characteristics the sources highlight, non-excludable and non-rivalrous.
Non-excludable meaning you can't stop people using it.
Even if they don't pay. And non-rivalrous means one person using it doesn't stop someone else using it.
The classic examples in the material are national defense, streetlights.
Exactly. Because of those features, you get the free rider problem. People can benefit without paying.
So private firms wouldn't make a profit?
Generally not. It's hard to charge everyone. Yeah. So the government often steps in and funds it through taxes.
But the sources also say they provide merit goods directly too, like healthcare, education, even though a market could provide them.
Yes. And the rationale there is usually about equity and access. Ensuring everyone can get healthcare or schooling, regardless of income.
So it's about reducing inequality, maybe boosting long-term growth.
Those are often the stated goals. Promote social welfare.
The advantages seem clear, universal access, fixing the underprovision problem.
Absolutely. But the material also flags potential drawbacks.
Like inefficiency. Because there's no profit motive driving things.
That's a common concern. Risk of waste, maybe slower innovation, more bureaucracy compared to the private sector.
So it's a trade-off again. Access versus potential efficiency.
Always trade-offs in policy.
Okay, let's shift gears again. Price controls. Setting legal price limits.
Maximum and minimum prices. Yeah.
First, maximum prices, price ceilings. The sources say these are set below the equilibrium.
Correct. Below where the market would naturally settle.
And the goal is usually affordability. Making essentials cheaper. Rent controls are mentioned. Basic food prices.
Exactly. Trying to help lower income households, often.
But the consequence, as the sources describe it, is shortages.
Excess demand. Prices held artificially low, so consumers want to buy more than producers are willing to sell at that low price.
Leading to queues, waiting lists.
And potentially black markets, where people sell the good illegally at a higher price. It messes with the market's balancing act.
Then the opposite. Minimum prices, or price floors. Set above equilibrium.
Right. Above the natural market price.
Minimum wage is the big example cited, guaranteeing a basic income level for workers.
Or guaranteed prices for farmers trying to stabilize their income.
But here the problem is excess supply.
Potentially, yes. At the higher mandated price, more is supplied than demanded.
So for minimum wage, the sources warn it could lead to unemployment if firms can't afford the higher wage for everyone.
That's the risk debated in the material. Fewer jobs offered at the higher wage rate. For farm goods, it can mean surpluses the government might have to buy up.
Which creates its own costs and storage problems.
Indeed.
The material kind of summarizes the general issues with price controls, doesn't it?
It does. They distort those crucial market signals that prices normally send.
Can lead to illegal trading.
Black markets, yeah. And potentially long-term inefficiency, because investment might be discouraged if prices are capped or costs are artificially inflated.
Okay, next up. buffer stock schemes. These sound specific.
They are, usually for agricultural commodities, things with naturally volatile prices. The sources mention coffee, wheat.
Right, where harvests vary a lot year to year.
Exactly. So the mechanism described involves setting up an agency.
And this agency buys and sells the commodity.
That's the core idea. When there's a glut, a big harvest, and prices fall low, the agency buys up the surplus and stores it, builds a buffer.
Okay. And when there's a shortage, maybe a bad harvest, and prices shoot up.
The agency sells from its stock, releasing supply onto the market to keep the price down.
So the main aim is just smoothing things out. Price stability.
Price stabilization, yes. That's the central goal. Meant to help producers by making incomes more predictable.
Allows them to plan better.
And helps consumers by avoiding sudden price spikes for essentials.
Advantages seem to be that stability then? Predictability for everyone?
That's the potential benefit. But the sources are quite clear about the practical difficulties.
Like what?
Well, they're expensive. Storage costs money, maintenance, preventing spoilage, especially for food.
Yeah, you can't just store wheat forever, easily.
There's also the risk of poor management, maybe even corruption in the agency running it.
And what if there's a long-term trend? Like, consistently good harvests, pushing prices down year after year.
That's a major problem. The agency could end up spending huge amounts buying surpluses indefinitely or run out of money. Or if there's a long-term shortage, they eventually just run out of stock to sell. They work best for short-term fluctuations, not persistent trends.
Right, okay. One last tool mentioned in the material providing information seems less direct.
Less direct than taxes or price controls, maybe, but still a key intervention. It tackles asymmetric information.
Where one side knows more than the other in a deal, usually the seller knowing more than the buyer.
Often, yes. Consumers might not know the health risks of smoking, for example, or the energy usage of an appliance they're buying. The sources give those examples.
So the government steps in to bridge that gap.
Tries to, yes. The methods described include things like forcing companies to put clear labels on products.
Food nutrition labels, cigarette warnings, energy ratings on fridges.
Exactly. Also, public health campaigns think anti-smoking ads. Consumer protection laws ensuring products are safe, rules about truth in advertising.
And the benefit is just better choices.
Better informed consumers making choices that are actually better for them, which leads to more efficient markets overall because decisions aren't based on ignorance or deception. It corrects that specific market failure.
Makes sense. But the sources also say just giving information isn't always enough.
Right. Its effectiveness depends on a few things. Do people trust the government source?
Good point.
Is the information actually understandable? Think about different literacy levels or complex technical data.
Yeah, a complex energy label might not help everyone.
And is there enforcement? Making sure companies are actually complying and not finding ways to mislead people anyway. Information needs to be trustworthy, accessible, and, you know, acted upon.
Wow, okay. So quite a range of tools we've covered, all drawn from your sources. We've got taxes, subsidies, direct provision.
Price controls, buffer stocks, providing information. Quite the arsenal.
And the big takeaway from the material seems to be that there are all attempts to fix market failures, promote fairness, or allocate resources better.
But none of them are perfect. As we saw, each one has upsides and downsides, advantages and disadvantages.
Always trade-offs involved.
Always. That's the recurring theme.
So understanding these mechanisms straight from the sources you shared is really valuable for anyone listening.
Absolutely. Whether you're studying this stuff or just trying to understand a news headline about a new tax or regulation.
Knowing the how and the potential whys and what might happen next based on this material really helps you evaluate what's going on. Helps you see the potential impact on yourself too.
It makes you a more informed citizen.
Definitely. Which brings us to a final thought maybe. Considering all these complexities, all the pros and cons for each tool that your sources laid out, makes you wonder, doesn't it? How do policymakers actually weigh these things up and decide which tool is the best fit for a specific problem, given that none seem perfect?
And can any intervention ever be truly perfect, or is it always about choosing the least imperfect option?
Yeah, something to chew on long after this deep dive finishes.